Did you get wet coming here? Yes. Well, I hope you stay warm and don't catch cold with the air conditioning. It's really raining hard out there. So, seems a little bit low. My mouth is here, and this is here. Now you probably can't see me, right? Okay. It'd be nice if this could be. I don't think that's possible. Thank you. Okay, so let's begin like yesterday with some meditation to calm down our minds and get our minds into a positive state for what we're going to do this afternoon. So first of all, sit in a position that is comfortable, where you don't have too much pain, but also a good position for meditation. That means keeping the back straight, if possible, but still letting your shoulders relax. Don't have your shoulders tight and tense. Let them be relaxed. Have your legs crossed in whatever position is comfortable for you. Those who are sitting on the floor, and those who are sitting in chairs, just have your 2 feet flat on the floor. And you can have your hands resting in your lap. That's the usual way we do in the Tibetan tradition, but some people put their hands on their knees when they meditate, and that's okay too. As for the eyes, it's better not to close them all the way, because doing that can lead to sleepiness. We might find ourselves falling asleep. So if you are feeling sleepy, if you think you might become sleepy during the meditation, then have your eyes open just a little bit with the gaze directed downwards onto your lap or the floor in front of you. So keeping the eyes open a little bit lets some light come in, and that can help to prevent sleepiness and also dullness, mental dullness, a kind of heavy, sinking state of mind. So let your body relax in this position. If you have tension anywhere in your body, see if you can let it go. You could imagine that it melts and flows out of you and sinks into the ground below. Or imagine that it evaporates and disappears in space. It can also help to take a couple of deep breaths. So you breathe in slowly, deeply, and then exhale slowly. You can imagine if there's tension in your body, it goes out with the exhalation of breath. So do that for 3 breaths, breathing in slowly, breathing out slowly. Do that 3 times, then go back to your usual rate of breathing. So just continue breathing in a natural way. With your body as relaxed as possible. And also try to relax your mind. You can do that by letting go of any thoughts there may be in your mind, thoughts of the past or thoughts of the future, thoughts of other places, problems. So anything. So just let your mind rest on the breath flowing in and flowing out. And in that way, the mind settles down in the present, the here and now. Remember that all thoughts in the mind are impermanent, transitory. They're like clouds in the sky, They come and they go, but they're not permanent. So just notice the thoughts. Don't deny them. Don't pretend they're not there. They are there, but they're not permanent. So you can just notice them and then let them go and return your attention, your awareness to the breath. The breath flowing in and flowing out. So now, go into your mind and try to understand why you came here today. What was your reason or motivation for coming here? And do this in an honest way. Be really honest with yourself. What was your real reason for coming here? So people can have different reasons for coming to an event like this. Some may have a really positive, altruistic intention, wanting to benefit themselves, to better themselves, to help the world, help others. But some may have other reasons, such as curiosity, wanting to check out what's happening, wanting to learn something new and interesting, or wanting to be with friends, not wanting to be alone on a Sunday afternoon. So whatever reason we may have initially for coming to an event like this, we can always change it. We can always work on it and improve it. So most probably all of us, deep down inside, are just looking for happiness. We want to be happy. We want to have positive experiences. We don't want to suffer or have bad experiences. So this is actually what happens in everybody's mind. All the 7 billion human beings in the world and all other living beings who have a mind, we're all just trying to find happiness and trying to avoid suffering, pain, problems. And according to Buddhism, that's not wrong. It's not selfish or bad to want to be happy. According to Buddhism, we actually should be happy. We have the ability, we have the potential to be truly happy, especially in a long-term way. We all have the ability to reach a state of perfect peace and happiness and even enlightenment. So that's our nature, our potential. And if we're not happy, if we have problems, it's mainly because of confusion in our mind. Confusion and other disturbing emotions like greed, anger, jealousy. So these pop up in our mind, disturb our mind, make it unpeaceful and unhappy, and it can also spill over into our relationships with others, the way we act, the way we talk to others, and we can make them unhappy too. But our real nature, according to Buddhism, is pure and peaceful and positive. We just need to realize that. We need to get in touch with our pure nature and bring it out, make it manifest more and more of the time. And then the disturbing aspects of the mind, the confusion, the greed, the anger, and so forth, these are not our real nature. They're like pollution that got mixed up with our mind, but can be removed, can be cleared away. Just like we could take pollution out of the water and make it pure again. So we can also take the pollution out of our mind and make it pure. That's really what Buddha's teachings are all about. How to purify our mind of the pollution that causes problems and unhappiness for ourselves and others, so that we can be more happy, peaceful, free of suffering, free of the causes of suffering. So if that makes sense to you, then see if you can think that your reason or motivation for being here today is to learn ways in which you can work on yourself, your mind, make it more positive, peaceful, happy. And if possible, if you can also feel the wish to help others, to help other people also be more positive and peaceful and happy, then that's really fantastic. So see if you can generate such thoughts in your mind as your reason, your motivation for being here today. And then, before you open your eyes, let's recite the mantra of the Buddha 3 times, as we did yesterday. If you don't know it, you can just listen and maybe you can pick it up and follow along. Is that okay? The sound okay? You can hear okay? So welcome again to all of you. I see some faces who were not here yesterday, so I'll just briefly mention what we talked about yesterday. So I was asked to talk about my own journey, how I got involved in Buddhism and ended up being a Buddhist nun. And so I talked about that a little bit yesterday. I didn't want to go into too many details because I think it's boring. But I can add little stories here and there as I go along. I'm more interested in talking about Buddhism itself. So that was the second thing I was asked to talk about, introduction to Tibetan Buddhism. And I'm sure many of you have heard this before, but I think there may be a few people who are relatively new and might be hearing some of this material for the first time. So yesterday I gave an introduction to Buddhism itself, Buddhism in general. I talked a little bit about Buddha's life and his first teaching, in which he taught the Four Noble Truths. And then we went through the Four Noble Truths and did a meditation on the Four Noble Truths. Then I talked a little bit about some of the different traditions. Well, first, how Buddhism spread after the time of the Buddha. And eventually it spread throughout Asia, most Asian countries. And then in the last two centuries, it has also spread to other countries. So Europe, America, North America, South America, you know. There's probably not many countries nowadays where you wouldn't find Buddhism. Maybe a few. But then, you know, with the internet, even people living in countries where there are no Buddhist teachers or Buddhist centers, they can still learn Buddhism from the internet. There's lots of online courses and, of course, YouTube videos of teachings. So as long as people have access to the internet, then, you know, anywhere they are, they can learn Buddhism. So it's become, you know, quite well known and spread throughout the world. Then at the end of the class, I just gave an introduction to the two main traditions of Buddhism, Theravada and Mahayana. And so today I would like to focus more on Tibetan Buddhism, but I'll start by just talking a bit more about Mahayana. I just briefly mentioned Tibetan Buddhism is part of Mahayana Buddhism. And in Mahayana Buddhism, in general, our goal, our aim is Buddhahood. We want to become Buddha. We want to follow in the Buddha's footsteps and do what he did, which is quite extraordinary, actually. It's not an easy thing to do at all. But on the other hand, it's the best thing that we could do, the best thing for ourselves, because it totally transforms our own mind, making it totally free of every type of problem and incorrect mental state. So it's like totally purifying everything incorrect about the mind, and then developing all the positive potential of the mind, all the good qualities like kindness and love and compassion and wisdom. So these are fully developed. And so it's a big job, becoming a Buddha. It's the biggest job there is. But it's worthwhile, because it's, like I say, it's the best thing we can do for ourselves, but it's also the best thing we can do for others. And that's the whole point. The whole point of becoming a Buddha is to benefit others. Somebody who aspires for Buddhahood, works for Buddhahood, does so because they want to help the world. They want to help all living beings, without exception. Okay, so it's not that you only want to help Buddhists and forget about the rest. No. All living beings, every living being, you want to help them to be free of their suffering and to find peace and happiness as well. Okay, so that's the ultimate final goal of the Mahayana path. But of course, you know, even before becoming a Buddha, reaching that end result, as you're going along the way, you are helping yourself and you are helping others. Okay, so your own mind gets more and more positive and peaceful and happy, and your ability to help others increases as well. So it's not that you have to wait until you're a Buddha before you can help others. Of course not. You can be helping others along the way as well. So that's just in general Mahayana, and let's see. And just to look at some of the different schools or divisions of Mahayana. We'll do this just briefly because I'm actually not a scholar. Like, I know everything about Buddhism and Buddhist history and so on, but just to give you some idea. Okay, so one popular, well-known Mahayana school is Chan, or Zen. Zen is very well-known in the West. It's probably the most popular type of Buddhism in places like America. But not everyone realizes that Zen actually came from China. They know about Zen, but not many people know about Chan. So Buddhism went from India to China, and they're actually the word Chan is Chinese, but it's the Chinese version of jhana. Jhana is the Sanskrit. Oh no, jhana is Pali, jhana is Sanskrit, and this is the type of meditation where you concentrate your mind, you develop single point of concentration. And then on the basis of that, you attain these states of mind. There's four jhanas that are just, you know, incredibly peaceful, blissful, concentrated states of mind. Okay, so it's jhana in Sanskrit, and then when it went to China, they made it into chan. Okay, and then when it went to Japan, they made it into zen. So this is Mahayana Buddhism. This is a form of Mahayana. And it first went to China in the 4th or 5th century, the Common Era, introduced by an Indian master named Bodhidharma. And then later it moved from China to Japan and also Korea. Okay. So in this tradition, the emphasis is on meditation. They do a lot of meditation. Sometimes in Zen monasteries, they meditate 20 hours a day. Hard work. And it's similar to Vipassana, which we find in the Theravada tradition. Anyway, I'm not I'm not really a scholar. I'm just mentioning this, that because not everybody realizes the different divisions of Mahayana Buddhism. So within Zen, this is the Japanese form, there's two divisions. One is called Soto Zen. Soto, in that practice, the emphasis is on sitting, mainly just sitting and focusing your mind, not thinking too much, not studying too much, just focusing on concentration. And then another form is called Rinzai. And I know these have Chinese forms as well. I just don't know the Chinese terms for these. Rinzai uses koans. It's a kind of riddle the teacher will give you, like the sound of one hand clapping, or what was your original face before you were born, or something like that. Something that doesn't have any intellectual answer that we can come to. But you contemplate this, and it's a way of breaking through the mistaken states of mind that we have that prevent us from attaining enlightenment. Another form of Mahayana Buddhism is called Pure Land Buddhism. This was also very popular in China and in Japan and Korea, also Vietnam, also in Tibet. This practice exists in Tibet. So in Mahayana Buddhism, there isn't just one Buddha, like Shakyamuni Buddha, but many Buddhas. For example, Amitabha Buddha. I'm sure everyone's heard of Amitabha Buddha, right? Omitofo. Very well-known Buddha. So there are actually many Buddhas, and some of these Buddhas have established a pure land, a place where devotees can go after they die, and there the point isn't just to go there and enjoy yourself like going on a holiday, but rather you go there to continue practicing and developing yourself, developing your ability to reach enlightenment, and eventually you become a Buddha too, and then you can help other living beings. So it's a little bit similar to the idea of heaven. In theistic religions, you know, if you behave yourself well and you pray a lot, and practice in the right way, then when this life ends, you can go to one of these pure lands, such as Amitabha's pure land, which is called Sukhavati, meaning the land of bliss. And there you can continue to practice. You don't have so many problems like in this lifetime. You don't have to, you know, go to work and pay taxes and all those kind of things. So you just practice all the time. But again, it should be done with the right motivation, not just to enjoy yourself, but so that you can benefit others, you can benefit the world. So in this practice, you focus on Amitabha Buddha, and then you recite either his name or his mantra, and visualize this pure land. And you do this practice again and again through your life, and in that way you create the cause to be born in such a pure land after this life ends. So Amitabha is one example of a Buddha in a pure land, but there are others as well. It's just that he's probably the most popular one. And then a third form of Mahayana is Vajrayana. And I want to emphasize this because sometimes people have the idea that Vajrayana is a separate type of Buddhism, a separate school of Buddhism. Some people even say there's three yanas. There's Hinayana or Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana as if it's off there by itself. But that isn't the case. Vajrayana is part of Mahayana. It's a branch of Mahayana. So what that means is it's practiced with the goal of reaching enlightenment, becoming a Buddha to benefit all living beings. But it contains certain practices, special practices, that are not found in other forms of Mahayana. And I'll talk about that later if we have time, just to make that more clear. It's quite well known and spread in Tibet, Tibetan Buddhism. I'm sure most, if not all, people following Tibetan Buddhism will practice Vajrayana. But it also exists in Mongolia. Also in China, it did go into China in the past, in the 8th century. I think the Chinese term is Shenyan. Does that sound familiar? How do you say that? Shenyan? I found that in Wikipedia. It means esoteric Buddhism. Yeah. So there were Indian masters such as Vajrabodhi and Amoghavajra who went from India to China in the 8th century, and they brought this form of Buddhism. So it was practiced for a while, but then in the 9th century there was a kind of anti-Buddhist persecution under Emperor Wuzong of the Tang Dynasty. So then it sort of decreased. Probably other traditions of Buddhism decreased as well. But later it did increase, especially after the Mongol conquest of China in the 13th century. So when the Mongols took over China, they actually established Tibetan Buddhism as the official religion of China. So there were many lamas from Tibet living in China, teaching in China. So then Vajrayana Buddhism again became more widespread. And then this form of Buddhism also went from China to Japan, and there it is called Shingon Buddhism. I don't know if anyone's heard of that, but that is still practiced today. It may not be the most well-known or widespread form of Japanese Buddhism, probably Zen is, but it is practiced. There are temples and monasteries practicing Vajrayana Buddhism in Japan. Okay, and but again, the practice of Vajrayana should be based on the basic teachings of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, ethics, of course, bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. So one should have a good foundation in the basic teachings and basic practices of Buddhism, and then on top of that, one engages in Vajrayana. You shouldn't just jump into Vajrayana without having a good basis in those others. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. And also, to practice Vajrayana, one needs to first receive what's called an empowerment or initiation. And that qualifies you to engage in this type of practice. And then you also need to practice under the guidance of teachers explaining to you how to do the practices. And it contains a practice known as deity yoga. I'll explain a bit more about this later. First, I want to talk about some other things, but some of these terms that you may be unfamiliar with, they'll become more clear later. But I guess what I really want to emphasize here is that Vajrayana is a type of Mahayana. Okay. So in Tibetan Buddhism, at least in the tradition that I followed, the Gelugpa tradition, study is emphasized. It's considered very important to study so that we have a good understanding, good knowledge and understanding of the Buddha's teachings, the path that we are trying to follow, and so on. So study is emphasized because they say if we just If we just try to meditate, you know, some people don't want to study. They just want to meditate. They say, if you try to meditate without study, it's like trying to go mountain climbing without arms. So, you know, you just won't know what to do and how to, you know, progress along the path and how to deal with the different obstacles and make sure you are going in the right direction. So study is very important, and I feel very fortunate that I've had the chance to study for many years and receive some wonderful teachings from some wonderful teachers. So in our tradition, it's explained that Mahayana has two divisions, and the term Mahayana itself means great vehicle. That's the English translation. And this word vehicle sounds a little strange, right? When we hear the word vehicle, we probably think of a car or a truck or a motorcycle, right? But, and I think that is the term, yana, the Sanskrit term yana, does mean vehicle. But here it doesn't mean that kind of vehicle with wheels that you drive around in and so on. Instead, it means a state of mind. The real meaning of yana is a mental state. And not just a normal, ordinary, everyday kind of mental state, but a realized one, a realization. Okay, so it means a highly accomplished state of mind. Because what we're trying to do, we're trying to reach enlightenment, and that's a state of mind. Enlightenment is a state of mind. And it doesn't happen all at once, you know, from one moment to the next. Instead, it happens gradually. It's a gradual transformation of the mind. And as you are going along towards enlightenment, you're gaining these realizations. Realizations are happening in your mind. And that's what enables you to progress and eventually reach enlightenment. So these realizations, these states of mind that happen in your mind are what's meant by yana. And also the word path, when we talk about a path is also a state of mind. It's a realization. So it's like our mind progresses through these different stages or different steps or different paths, and eventually we reach enlightenment. Okay, so Mahayana, or great vehicle, and some translate it as universal vehicle. Because the idea of Mahayana, it's a great big ocean liner where you can fit everybody. Instead of just taking yourself to a state of peace and happiness, liberation, nirvana, Mahayana is a great big huge vehicle where you can fit everybody else, all sentient beings, all living beings. That's our goal. We want to take all living beings out of suffering and to enlightenment as well. So that's why it's called the Mahayana, the great vehicle, or universal vehicle. And it has two divisions. One is called a perfection vehicle. That's a translation of Paramitayana. And another term for that is Sutrayana. And then the second is the Vajra vehicle, or Vajrayana, or Tantra. Okay. So again, I'm just trying to emphasize Vajrayana is a type of Mahayana. And it's one of these two types, Paramitayana and Vajrayana. And they have certain things in common. So we'll look at what they have in common, and then later I'll talk about what are the distinguishing features, the uncommon features of Vajrayana. So what they have in common is, first of all, the motivation or the goal, which I mentioned already. The goal is becoming a Buddha, becoming fully enlightened, and doing that because you want to help others. You want to benefit other beings, all living beings, without exception. Another thing they have in common is the Lam Rim. Lam Rim is a Tibetan term, and Lam means path, Rim means stages. So we translate it as stages of the path. And some of you have heard that term. Some of you have studied the Lam Rim. Lam Rim is a way of presenting Buddha's teachings in a kind of step-by-step way, showing us what we need to do to get from where we are now as an unenlightened being. I mean, maybe some of you are already enlightened. Excuse me, don't want to be insulting, but I'm not enlightened, and I assume some of the others here are not enlightened either. So those of us who are not yet enlightened, not yet Buddhas, so how do we get from here to enlightenment? Okay? And like I said, it's not just an instant thing. It doesn't happen in one instant. It happens in stages, in steps. It's a bit like if you want to go on a journey. Okay, let's say you have this ambitious plan to drive from here to Bangkok. I don't know if anybody would ever do that. I mean, most people would fly, but if you did want to go overland from here to Bangkok, then you need to go in various stages, okay, which highways you take, which towns you pass through, and so on and so forth. So your journey has different stages. Okay, so in a similar way, getting from our present state as unenlightened to enlightenment, Buddhahood, there are different stages that we go through. So that's the meaning of the Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment. What do we have to do to get enlightened? So the Tibetan masters, actually it started with an Indian master, Atisha. Atisha was a great Indian master who lived about 10th century Common Era. And he was invited to Tibet by the king of Tibet because things were a little bit messy in Tibet at that time. There was already Buddhism, but there were a lot of wrong ideas and wrong practices, some corruption, confusion, and so on. So the king wanted to kind of, you know, clean up this mess and try to establish a more correct form of Buddhism. And he thought we could invite a great Indian master to come and teach. So the greatest master at that time was Atisha. So he was invited to Tibet, and he came, and he stayed in Tibet for I don't know how many years, but quite a few years until he died, and taught and wrote texts. And he's the first author of this Lam Rim type of text. He wrote a text on the stages of the path. It's called The Lamp for the Stages of the Path, Bodhipatapradipa in Sanskrit, and that was like the original Lam Rim text. And then after that, other Tibetan masters wrote other texts, such as Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelugpa tradition. He wrote several Lam Rim texts. One is called the Lam Rim Chenmo, which is huge. Chenmo means big. No, it is. It's big. In English, there's an English translation. It's in three volumes. Is there a Chinese translation? I think there is. There is. Huh? Ancient Chinese. So it's not kind of contemporary. Yeah. So maybe a little hard to read. Okay. Anyway, it has been translated into numerous languages. And that's a very detailed, extensive explanation of the stages of the path. But even in English, it's not easy to read. It's a bit scholarly. It's wonderful, but it's scholarly. So, beginners might have a hard time with it. But anyway, there is this genre of texts and teachings that explain the stages of the path to enlightenment. And Ken Rinpoche Geshe Chuni has taught that here a number of times, right? So I'm sure many of you have had the chance to study it, to learn it. Anyway, so the Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment, has to be learned and practiced both whether you're following the perfection vehicle or you're following the Vajra vehicle. Okay, so you can't skip over that and just jump right into Tantra. It's not going to work. And then another thing in common is the practice of the six perfections. Six perfections are six practices which are the most important practices to do by someone who wants to reach enlightenment, to become a Buddha. There's the term bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a person who is aiming for enlightenment. You know, they're really dedicated to becoming enlightened. They're a bit like a medical student, somebody who's in medical school with the goal of becoming a doctor. Okay, so they're not just thinking, oh, I'd like to become a doctor one day and not doing anything about it. But, you know, once you enter medical school and you're studying and you're doing all the work you have to do, then you're well on the way to becoming a doctor. So Bodhisattva's a bit like that, someone who's well on the way, training and studying and working and doing everything that has to be done to become a Buddha. So the main practices of a Bodhisattva are called the six perfections. So I know some of you know what they are. Could you just mention what are the six, or even if you can just remember one of them? First one? Generosity or giving. Second is, ethics or morality. There's different translators like different terms. I like ethics. And number three, patience. Yeah, that's very important. How to not get angry and lose our patience and have a temper tantrums and so on. And number four, joyous effort. Yeah, sometimes it's called enthusiasm or enthusiastic perseverance. I like joyous effort. It sounds nice. Because the idea is to be joyful, to engage in good deeds, do good things with joy, and not because you have to, your teacher told you to, but because you really enjoy it, you're really happy to do it. Number five, concentration. Concentration, that means learning to focus the mind so that it's not wandering all over the place. And we'll have some classes in that coming up on Tuesday, how to learn to meditate and try to get a bit more concentration. Last one, number six. Wisdom, very important one. So we'll talk a bit more about that later. What is wisdom? So anyway, whether you're following the Paramitayana or the Vajrayana, you have to practice the six perfections. They're essential. The last point here is the need for both method and wisdom. So method, you've probably heard this expression. They say that method and wisdom are the two most important things we need to reach enlightenment, and they're compared to the two wings of a bird. So just as a bird cannot fly if it has only one wing, right? You can flap that one wing, but it's not going to be able to get off the ground. So in the same way, someone who wants to go to enlightenment needs two wings, not just one wing. And the two wings are called method and wisdom. And method actually consists of the first five perfections. And these are practiced with compassion, with love, with altruism, with the wish to benefit others, giving, ethics, and so forth. You do these with the motivation of helping others. And then the other wing is wisdom. Wisdom means understanding the true nature of things. So in a simple way, we can say the two wings are compassion and wisdom. Those need to be balanced. If we only have compassion but no wisdom, then it becomes like stupid compassion. I'm sorry, that's maybe not a very nice term, but it does happen sometimes. You know, people are very compassionate. They want to help others, but if they don't know how to help, they don't have wisdom and skill, sometimes the things they do might not help and they could even make things worse. You've probably had experience of that. I see people nodding their heads. I know I have. You know, you want to help somebody, but if you don't know how to help them, you know, then you can mess things up even more. Okay? So we need to have wisdom to balance our compassion, but we also need to have compassion to balance wisdom, because if you have wisdom but lack compassion, you may be very intelligent, you may have a lot of knowledge, and you know, you can talk about emptiness, meditate on emptiness, and so on. But if you're lacking in compassion, then it's almost like you're a robot. I mean, almost, not exactly, but, you know, it's like you're kind of cold and unfeeling and uncaring. And when it comes to helping others, you may think, oh, I don't have time, I'm too busy studying or meditating or so. So if you have only one of those two but not the other, then it's not perfect, it's not ideal, it's imbalanced. So it's very important to have both compassion and wisdom. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. So I mentioned already the Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment. And this is actually very vast and very extensive. I remember when I was here in the 90s, we did a Lam Rim, we had a Lam Rim course. We were studying one Lam Rim text called Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand by Pabongka Rinpoche. And I think it took 4 years. We spent 4 years going through that text. And you could easily spend more if you really go into details and really spend time going on each point. So the full explanation of the Lam Rim is quite vast. But there's a way of condensing the essential points of the Lam Rim into these three points, which are called the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. So I'm going to spend time this afternoon talking about these, explaining them, and we'll also do meditation on them. And so for those of you who are maybe not so familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, this will give you some idea of some of the practices that we do in Tibetan Buddhism, some of the things we, you know, learn about, think about, meditate on, and so on. And for those who've already heard this before, this will serve as a reminder. It doesn't hurt to be reminded. You know, one time I was attending teachings by the Dalai Lama. I think this was also back in the 90s, so about 20 years ago. And he was teaching the Lam Rim Chenmo, the extensive version of the Lam Rim by Lama Tsongkhapa. And he said that he has read that text 72 times. And I was like, oh, because it's not like a little book. It's huge. Yeah, 72 times. I mean, how... Usually, you know, when we read a book, we think, oh, I read that book already, and we put it away, and we don't read it again. But I mean, to me, that really shows that it's with this kind of text, this kind of material, it's not enough to read it only once, but you need to read it again and again. And each time you do, you learn something new, and even the things you already thought you knew, you might understand them in a deeper way, in a different way. Okay, so I always try to encourage people not to think, oh, I've heard that before, I know that already, and then shut off, or, you know, start looking at their phone and seeing what messages they have. By the way, I think we forgot to ask everyone, please turn off your phones if you haven't already done so, so we don't get those noises interrupting. Okay, so we're going to go through these, and again, also in terms of Vajrayana Buddhism, if you do want to practice Vajrayana, then it needs to be done on the basis of these three. These are actually said to be requirements. Before you take a Vajrayana initiation, a Vajrayana empowerment, and start doing Vajrayana practice, they say you should have learned and have a good understanding of, and ideally, you know, some kind of experience in the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. Because if you try to practice Vajrayana and you don't have that, if you don't have these well set in your mind, then you're not really practicing Vajrayana. Even if you recite prayers and mantras and visualize deities and so on and so forth, it doesn't really become Vajrayana practice in the sense of, you know, transforming your mind to enlightened mind. So I think it's, you know, it would be like a little kid getting into the driver's seat of a car and sitting there and turning the steering wheel and pretending that they're driving, but the car isn't going anywhere, Right. So they're having fun, they're enjoying themselves, but you know, it's not really functioning the way a car should. So in the same way, if we, you know, try to follow the Vajrayana practice, but we don't do it with the right basis, the right foundation, then it's not really going to take us to enlightenment. Okay, so first I'll just mention what the three are, and then we'll go through them one by one. So the first one is called the determination to be free. Sometimes it's called renunciation. But that term sometimes puts people off, so the determination to be free might sound a bit more interesting, something we'd like to do. And that has two divisions or two types. One is called renunciation of this life, which probably sounds very strange, but we'll explain it. And the second is renunciation of cyclic existence or samsara. And the second is the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. It's the motivation to work for the benefit of all living beings and become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. And the third is the correct view of emptiness. So we'll go through these one by one, and hopefully you'll get a bit more understanding of them. So the first is renunciation of this life, okay? And that doesn't mean giving up our wish to live and wanting to die, okay? It may sound like that, but that's not the meaning. Instead, what it means is changing our priorities. So many people, maybe most people in the world, their number one priority is just this life, just taking care of this life in terms of making sure we're comfortable and happy, we have a job, we have a house, we have a family, you know, just the things of this life. This is the main priority, where we put most of our time and energy. And most people, as I say, probably don't have much concern about what's going to happen when this life ends and we die. And according to Buddhism, this isn't a very wise thing to do. And I think this is not only Buddhism. I think most religions would encourage their followers to not only focus on this lifetime, but think about what's coming next. Because, you know, some people may think, oh, but, you know, that's a long way off. Why do I need to think about that now? But we don't know. We don't know how long we're going to live. We don't know. Even if you're young, even if you're a teenager or you're in your 20s, yeah, we don't know when this life is going to come to an end. It has nothing to do with age. I lost a nephew just a few months ago. He was only 32 years old. And of course we know of people dying in their 20s, of children dying. Okay? So it's not a question of how old you are. It's also not even a question of health. You know, some people are very sick. They might have a terminal illness like cancer, but they may live longer than someone who's completely healthy, but who dies in a car accident or some other kind of accident. Okay, so Buddhism says it's very important to be aware of death, to be aware our life isn't going to last forever, it's going to end at some point, and we don't know when it's going to end. We should give some thought to that. Now, that's actually something I'm talking about later. The end of the month, right? There's a weekend course about death and dying, so I'll talk more about that then. But anyway, since this life is temporary, we're only here in a temporary basis, and then we have to leave this life, it does make sense to think about what happens next. But of course, there are many people in the world who think nothing happens. You know, when we die, that's it. It's like the candle goes out, the flame goes out, and there's nothing left. But according to Buddhism, and again, most if not all other religions, that's not true. There is something that continues, something that goes on after our body dies. And according to Buddhism, what goes on, we don't use the word soul. We don't talk about a soul, but rather the mind, our consciousness, this, it's hard to say what it is. It's not a physical thing, it's a non-physical thing. But it's that part of us that thinks and feels and knows and experiences. Okay, so that part of our being, our conscious part, the conscious part of us, that continues after we die. And then it takes another life. Buddhism talks about rebirth or reincarnation. So our mind will separate from this body, this life, and then go to another body or another life. And where we go, what happens to us, is not a question of choice. It's not that we get to choose. It's not that somebody's going to stand there and say, okay, where do you want to go? What do you want to be? Okay, what kind of person, what kind of life do you want to have? Of course, everybody would want a good life, the best possible. But, you know, as we can see in the world, a lot of people don't have good lives. A lot of people have horrible, horrible, horrible lives. So nobody would choose that kind of life. Yeah. So it's not a question of choice. It's a question of karma. Mainly it's our karma. The kind of actions we do, the behavior we engage in during our life. That's the main factor that determines our next life. That's why it's so important to look after karma. But anyway, according to Buddhism, it is important to think about the future, think about what happens after this life, and generate the determination to be free from suffering in future lives. So that's the meaning of renunciation of this life. That's why I put it in parentheses here. The meaning of renouncing this life, renunciation of this life, is I want to make sure that in my next life and subsequent lives, future lives, I won't have suffering, I won't have terrible experiences, and instead I will have good experiences, good rebirths and good experiences. So there are certain meditations that one does to generate this renunciation. One is the preciousness of our human life, according to Buddhism. This human life that we have is very, very precious compared with other life forms. You may have heard this story. It's in the sutras. One time the Buddha was with some of his disciples, and he said, imagine if the whole world is covered with water, like one great big huge ocean. And there's a tortoise living at the bottom of the ocean. And it's blind. Once every 100 years, this tortoise gets to come up to the surface and stick its head above the surface of the water. And then it goes down again. So just once in 100 years, it gets to come up. And on the surface of this ocean, there's a golden yolk, like a lifesaver, you know, this circle thing. And it's always moving around. The wind, the waves, the tides are moving it here and there, and it's never in the same place. So then the Buddha said, so what are the chances that when this tortoise comes up and sticks its head above the surface of the water, it's going to stick its head through the hole in this yolk? What do you think the disciples said? What are the chances? What would you bet if you're going to the betting station? Is it very likely? No. Very unlikely. Because remember, the tortoise is blind. It can't even see. The yolk is always in a different place. So that's what the Buddha's disciples said. Yeah, it's not very likely. And the Buddha said, in the same way, it's very rare to be born as a human being, to have a human life, a human body, human life. And it's also very rare to meet the teachings that, what we call the Dharma, the teachings that show the way to enlightenment. And he said, now you have both of these, so don't waste your time. So that's the idea of the precious human life. Now, some people may think, wait a minute, human life isn't that precious. There's 7 billion human beings in this world, and it's growing all the time. We have too many people. But precious human life doesn't just mean being human being. You're human, but you have good conditions in your life to be able to engage in spiritual practice. A lot of the people in this world are just on the edge of survival. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who struggle just to find enough food to fill their stomach every day. I just came from India, you know, and you see a lot of people there who are really, really suffering just to survive, just to keep themselves alive and their family, you know, fill their stomachs. And so if you're living in that way, you don't have much time to receive teachings, think about, meditate on, and, you know, really dedicate your life to spiritual practice. And then some people don't have the freedom. In some countries, you know, the government strictly controls information and what people are allowed to do. North Korea, for example, you know, you wouldn't have the freedom to come to a place like this and listen and meditate and so on and so forth. Some people don't have freedom because of their families. They're controlled by their families. Their families tell them what to do, especially women. Very little freedom. You do what we tell you to do or we kill you. I mean, it's really like that for a lot of women. Yeah. So freedom is another precious condition to have in one's life. And then another one is interest. I mean, a lot of people are just not interested. They're only interested in this life, enjoying themselves, making money, traveling, buying things, right? I mean, today the shopping centers are probably packed with people. I'm not saying it's wrong to go shopping, but, you know, I think people probably go shopping more than they really need to. Yeah? Not because they really need things, but just they don't know what else to do with themselves, okay? So that's where a lot of people are at. They could come and learn meditation and work on their minds, improving their minds, but they're just not interested. I'm sure you know people, your family, your friends, and so on, who think you're crazy to be coming here today, right? Why would you want to do this? What a waste of time. What a stupid thing to do, right? So that's another important condition that makes a precious human life. So if we remove all these, you know, people who either don't have the freedom, don't have the time, don't have the leisure, don't have the interest, then we come down to a relatively small number of human beings, right, who really want to engage in using their human life wisely in a beneficial way, in a meaningful way, to develop their minds. So that's the meaning of a precious human life. So it is rare. It is rare and precious. And if we have it, we have such a life with all these conditions, then the Buddha said we should make good use of it. Don't waste it. And the best thing we can do with this life is, well, follow the spiritual path, work for enlightenment, work for nirvana, you know, work on transforming our minds, make them more positive, less negative. And if that's too much to do, then at least try not to create bad karma. Because if we create bad karma, next life's going to be disaster, right? If we want to have a good life next time, then we have to make sure we create some good karma and avoid bad karma. So that's the general idea of the preciousness of the human life. And then in addition to that, we also contemplate the reality of death, the certainty of death. That's definitely going to happen to us, and it could happen any day. So if we do want to make something worthwhile with our life, we have to do it now and not put it off. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, think, oh yeah, right now I'm too busy, I don't have time, I have these other things I need to do. I'll do it later, when I retire, when the kids grow up. But we can't be sure. We'll still be alive then. Yeah? So we should at least start doing some practice now. Another thing to contemplate are the sufferings of the lower realms. I'm not going to go into details with those, but I mean, just think about animals. Animals have worse lives than we do. Much more suffering, much less freedom, much less intelligence, you know, being able to use their minds. When I was living here in Singapore in the past, I used to collect cats. I'm a cat lover. And, you know, there's lots of, you know, stray cats around. And when I would find a little kitten that obviously didn't have a mother, was an orphan, was hungry and so on, I just, you know, couldn't bear seeing it like that, so I would take it home. So I often had cats living with me, and I love them very much. But what I don't like about them is they kill. They like to kill. They have this strong instinct. If they see a mouse or a gecko or even a cricket insect, you know, they want to kill it. Not because they're hungry. I mean, they have plenty to eat. But it's just this instinct to kill. You can see it in the big cats, tigers and lions, and little cats. And you can talk to them all day long and say, no, that's bad karma. It's suffering. You're making them suffer, and you're going to suffer too. But they don't understand. So, yeah, so this is the unfortunate thing about being an animal, that they cannot understand even the most simple thing about karma. What's good karma? What's bad karma? They cannot understand. So it's very hard for them to work on their karma. But of course, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, our wonderful teacher, you know, has all kinds of ways to help animals. Take them around stupas, recite mantras in their ears, and so on and so forth. So there are things we can do to help them, but they themselves, from their side, being able to change themselves is very, very unlikely. So again, we want to try to avoid that kind of rebirth in our next life and at least get a human life again, because as a human being, we have more chances of improving ourselves and transforming our minds and helping others as well. That's another thing about animals too. Because I remember when I was in Kopan Monastery in the early days, just after I got ordained, one day I was sitting in my room, and then I heard this dog crying, like in distress and pain. So I went out to see what was going on, and I saw that the lamas had these little Tibetan dogs, like Lhasa Apsas, I think they're called, these cute little fluffy Tibetan dogs. So they had a few of those, and they usually lived upstairs. And there was a kind of roof, a flat roof, that they would run around on. So it seems that one of those dogs fell off the roof and was lying on the ground and crying. And other dogs, there were a number of other dogs. There's always dogs in Tibetan monasteries. Many of them are stray dogs. So all the other dogs had come, hearing the sound of this dog crying. And they were just standing around, this little dog, looking. Just looking at him. And that made it really clear to me one of the big limitations of the animal realm. You know, they can't even help each other. Even if, I don't know if they even felt the wish to help this little dog on the ground, or they were just curious, you know, wondering what's going on. But even if they did feel the wish to help, what could they do? You know, they don't have any medical science, they don't have medicine, they don't have doctors, they don't have anything they can do. Maybe lick the dog, you know, and but that's not going to do much good. But then human beings, you know, we can come along, pick up the dog, put him in the car, take him to the vet can fix him up, which did happen, so don't worry, the dog didn't die. I think he maybe had some injuries, but he was okay in the end. But, you know, animals among themselves, you know, are very limited, even in practical things like that, helping each other. Whereas human beings, we you know, of course, human beings can be very mischievous as well, very naughty. We can do lots of awful things, you know, war and terrorism and all these terrible things. So, but we can also do wonderful things. You know, human beings are capable. And I think there are more good things than bad things. I like to be optimistic. I used to be very pessimistic, but nowadays I'm optimistic. Because I think most people in the world are not committing murders, are not doing terrorist acts, are not raping, or not, you know, doing awful things. I think most people are behaving themselves, taking care of, you know, many people are parents and they're taking care of their kids. And then when the kids grow up, they take care of their aging parents, and people take care of their neighbors and friends. So I think most people are nice to other people and not doing awful things, don't you think? Yeah, we don't hear about that on the news. On the news, we hear about all the awful things that happen. But that's rare. That's unusual compared to all the good things that are happening. So as human beings, you know, we can do so much good. Just, you know, in an everyday way, taking care of our friends and our family and our neighbors and just being a good person, a kind person. So for future lives, it's much better to aspire to have a human rebirth and a life in which we can benefit others and continue following the spiritual path if we wish to. And the way to do that is taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. That's for a Buddhist, someone who wants to follow the Buddhist path. For a Christian or a Muslim, it would involve, you know, praying to God and following the word of God. But in Buddhism, we talk about taking refuge in the three jewels. And then the main thing is karma. That's how to ensure that when this life ends and we go to the next life, we'll be able to have a good situation and not a bad one, a horrible one. So that's the meaning of renunciation of this life. I'm squeezing it in, but there's a lot of material there, and if you're interested, you can learn more about it in the more extensive Lamrim teachings. But this is an important attitude we need to have as the basis, whether we want to practice the Paramita path or we want to practice the Vajrayana path. We need to feel some sense of commitment to using our life well, using our life wisely, which basically means refraining from bad karma, hurtful, harmful actions like killing and stealing and lying, and then trying to create good karma as much as we can, helping others, and being honest. Yeah. So at the very least, that's like the bottom line. That's like the first level of practice in Buddhism, no matter which kind of path you want to follow, which kind of goal you want to achieve. Okay, so how about if we have a break? You're probably ready for a break now. So let's have a break for 20 minutes. Start again at 3:45.